Chicago, 2011. A cop is murdered. Police and prosecutors swear they have the trigger man. He swears he didn't do it. How far will each side go to prove they're right?
Like it's just one bombshell after another, you know, where you're like, what?
The story of a PlayStation, a brain-eating amoeba, and the relentless pursuit of justice. Off Duty, out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to more news from WBEZ anytime on the WBEZ app. Start each day informed. Tap and listen live or on demand. Available on iOS and Android.
My taxes when I first bought my property were like $4,000. My property taxes are now are between 16 and 18.
To try to stop large teen gatherings that can turn violent, Alderman Brian Hopkins has tried and failed to pass a stricter curfew.
Thousands of protesters packed Grant Park chanting.
This is just not about electing people. This is making sure that the people have the power.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Cook County property taxes rose at double the rate of inflation over the last three decades. We're continuing to see a lot of upheaval among the mayor's top staff and among leadership in sister agencies. And for the first time, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling attended a public forum to address whether Chicago police helped federal immigration agents during Operation Midway Blitz. And it got heated.
Activists accused CPD of clearing the way for ICE agents at an immigration office.
I'm not afraid of taking these questions. I'm not afraid of exposing all of the information around this.
President Trump says Pam Bondi is out as U.S. Attorney General.
A potential legal battle is brewing between Mayor Brandon Johnson and the Chicago Housing Authority.
You can disagree with the result, but you can't ignore the process.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but let's start today's episode with a closer look at money that the city of Chicago is owed from an unlikely source. Joining us is Sophie Sherry, Chicago Sun-Times public safety reporter. Hey, Sophie.
Hey there.
So you just finished up an investigation. It was about the millions owed to Chicago by its own city workers. What are the details?
That's right. My Sun-Times colleague Tim Novak has done a bunch of these stories trying to get to the bottom of this city hall debt mess. Mm-hmm. In this latest version, Tim and I and a few of our WBEZ colleagues looked specifically at debt owed by city employees, as you mentioned, so people currently on the city's payroll. And it's no small amount. There's about $20 million in debt owed from active city employees. The overwhelming majority of those people are employed by the Board of Education or Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Transit Authority. And this is $20 million in debt racked up from unpaid water bills, parking violations in some cases, speeding tickets, building code issues.
And it sounds like a lot, but it's only a fraction of the city's unpaid debt, isn't it?
That's correct. We're just looking at a tiny slice of the pie here. The whole city debt is in the $8 billion range. But this is an interesting story because obviously we're looking at people who owe money that are currently receiving their paycheck from the city of Chicago.
And we couldn't just deduct these debts from city employee paychecks?
That's the question. And obviously, it's a difficult question. I mean, we know these individuals are getting paychecks. You know, we're not pulling from someone who is unemployed at the moment. But these debts aren't considered in hiring practices, though the department can garnish wages later. I think only about 50% of the employees on this list were actually having their wages garnished. Some aldermen feel very strongly that this is a approach the mayor needs to take, that they should be going after all these city employees that they can to start chipping away at that debt. But it's a difficult conversation here.
It's the first thing that came to my mind. Well, we're certainly glad you all did the reporting, and I look forward to checking it out in detail. It's up online right now, folks, at suntimes.com. Let's jump into the full recap. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Brandon Pope, freelance journalist and president of the Chicago chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and Nick Blumberg, WTTW news correspondent and host of Chicago Tonight's Week in Review. Now, we got news yesterday that the person in charge of immigration courts nationwide, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, has been fired. She repeatedly clashed with Illinois' political leaders over immigration policy. So I started the recap by running through some of those moments. So when Senator Dick Durbin opposed the White House sending in the National Guard to enforce immigration, she told him, quote, "I wish you could love Chicago as much as you hate President Trump." Under Bondi's leadership, the Department of Justice opened an investigation into whether Chicago and Mayor Brandon Johnson were, quote, "engaged in a pattern of discrimination." This was because he hired black officials for his administration. Governor Pritzker was also a target of her criticism. She accused him of prioritizing, quote, "illegal aliens over American citizens." Yesterday, the governor posted a picture on X of Pam Bondi under what looked similar to a LinkedIn logo with the hashtag open to work. Ouch. Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth was also quick to post on X saying, quote, "Pam Bondi turned our Department of Justice into the Department of Corruption, protecting pedophiles and going after Trump's enemies list at the expense of the American people," end quote. So, Brandon, any thoughts on, I mean, how all of this just seems compared to where we were, I'd say maybe a decade ago in terms of civility in politics? I mean, these folks are pulling all the punches here.
I mean, I remember a time where the attorney general didn't make news. Like, some people couldn't even tell you who that was,
That's
right?
That's very true.
I also remember a time where, like, attorney generals, like, were exhaustingly, painstakingly trying to make sure there was no conflict at all, right? Eric Holder was big about that. He didn't even want to be pictured with Barack Obama. Like, yo, like, please do not take a picture. So, to see the memeization of how our politics have gotten, the meme lords, the AI slop, and the barbs and insults, you are, you know, all this type of stuff.
Finger pointing galore.
It says a lot about our society as well, and what people expect, and what really drives people and animates people. It's rage, it's entertainment, but not much substance right now, and that's not great for anybody.
Do you think the DOJ is going to behave any differently under the new acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, Nick?
You know, there's not necessarily any indication. He's a longtime figure in Trump's circle. He has, you know, at various times represented folks like Rudy Giuliani and Paul Manafort. He has a long history, with sort of the MAGA movement. And, you know, in his role, you know, backing up Pam Bondi as her number two, he was essentially overseeing the day-to-day at the Department of Justice. So he was the one, you know, sort of making sure the trains run on time, trains which have been, you know, subject to quite a bit of political influence in a way that, you know, as Brandon points out, the DOJ was historically very, very loath to engage in. So, you know, this is someone who I don't think we can expect a sea change here. And I don't think that's what, you know, President Trump wants. It'll be interesting to see whether he gets the job permanently. There's been, a lot of reporting that Lee Zeldin, who's currently the head of the EPA, is potentially up for the job, another, you know, sort of Trump loyalist. So we'll see whether Blanche, you know, fully ascends to, you know, to the opinion, to the position, rather, of attorney general. But at least for the time being, I don't think we should expect any sort of major shakeup.
Sticking with immigration enforcement, for the first time, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling attended a public forum to address whether Chicago Police actually helped federal immigration agents back in the fall during Operation Midway Blitz. And you were there last night, Sophie. I hear things were a little heated. Set the scene.
Yeah, it was a bit tense at times, to say the least. There was a similar meeting held back in January where dozens of community members packed an auditorium to express frustrations about the way Chicago police responded to Operation Midway Blitz. Many accusing them of, like you said, illegally cooperating with ICE agents. Last night, they were able to take those complaints directly to Snelling. And Snelling stood firm in his response, standing by his department. He said his officers were out there making communities safer, de-escalating situations. This drew a lot of boos from the crowd at times. The entire meeting actually ended with chants of CPD, KKK, ICE, they're all the same, and a few members being escorted out.
Wow. What were your takeaways, Nick, from last night's forum? What stood out?
I think this is an instance where no one is going to walk away happy. You know, it was interesting to see Snelling point out that, listen, yes, we have this welcoming city ordinance. We have, you know, the requirement that, you know, the prohibition that CPD should not be coordinating with immigration agents except for very limited circumstances. But he also said, you know, this isn't the kind of immigration enforcement we've ever seen in the city. There was no playbook for this. That's something you've heard from a lot of local leaders. We've heard that from the Cook County State's attorney, who's saying, you know, folks want me to go out and prosecute immigration agents. I don't have that kind of authority, and we've never dealt with anything like this on the ground. So it's almost like, you know, Snelling, you know, had to be, by a lot of reporting, kind of had his arm twisted to get to this meeting. But, you know, which is, I guess, a win in and of itself for folks who think the department needs to be held more accountable. But at the end of the day, you know, there's not necessarily anybody who's going to walk away from this, I think, feeling great about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the fact that he was in the building was one thing, because he wasn't there at the one in January.
He was not there at the previous one. Nope.
Yesterday, he was on Say More, WBEZ's Say More, and a caller asked him why he refused to allow any outside experts to be part of the community conversation last night. So here's what Superintendent Snelling had to say.
There was no plan to have a panel. As the superintendent of police, I want to be there to make sure that I answer all of the questions that are coming in through CCPSA. If we have a panel up there that we haven't discussed and we don't know what the format is, the waters might be muddied.
So, Brandon, your thoughts on what he said there, right? The feeling that the waters might be muddied if there were other experts in attendance. Is that true?
I mean, it sounds like he just doesn't want a discussion and context around this. It's fascinating because, like, Snelling, for the most part, has been celebrated during his tenure, hasn't really faced a lot of pushback. I think the really only time he's had his arm twisted, in a sense, was when we talked about that great report from WBEZ about extremism within CPD's ranks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And his seeming lack of urgency to get it done. When I talked to him about that, he explained it's the process, bureaucracy, and he can't just wave a magic wand and fire people. He's kind of doing the same thing with this. However, I think this time the energy around what people want and desire, kind of like what Eileen O'Neill Burke was facing, is kind of a groundswell here, and that leads to a lot of tension and anger. We all saw what ICE did. They're in our communities. It hits close to home. And so people are passionate. They want to see action. They just don't feel it.
And let's be clear, the list of speakers being recommended for last night included immigration attorneys. Mm-hmm. We're talking experts on police accountability, community organizers. Experts like former Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
Yeah, these aren't just like random influencers on TikTok, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, and he sort of said, you know, these aren't necessarily people who understand the ins and outs of the operations of the Chicago Police Department. And it's like, well, okay.
The mayor doesn't?
Right, right. And the other thing, too, is, you know, it's not as though they were going sort of beat by beat and saying, how are you deploying, you know, why do you deploy two squads, you know, on this block versus one on this block? It wasn't that sort of a granular issue. This was more of a, you know, kind of a conceptual conversation about sort of the principles here and what they're supposed to be upholding. Yeah. So it struck me as a bit odd that, you know, he didn't want to engage with those folks.
And like Brandon mentioned, I think he does, and the same with State's Attorney O'Neill Burke, they do like to take it to this very granular level of, let me explain to you the inner workings. Any chance he got last night to pivot to, here's how things are working on the ground. And I mean, quite bluntly, why you all don't understand how this all works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they want to have those very detail oriented policy questions. And, you know, obviously they are they're walking a fine line here, all of them. CPD works frequently with federal agents in other capacities. So I think, Snelling's really trying to lean on what's actually by the books.
Right.
And how that can sort of work in their favor, maybe.
Well, I want to stick with federal agents and turn to another story that you reported on, Sophie. This was about a DePaul student accused of spitting on an ICE agent. What are the details?
That's right. This case has moved quickly, uncharacteristically quick for the Cook County court system. But yes, as you mentioned, a 20-year-old DePaul student was arrested on Tuesday for spitting on an ICE agent at O'Hare Airport over the weekend. He was charged with felony aggravated battery to a peace officer, or police officer in normal speak. And he appeared in court on Wednesday. I spoke to his lawyer afterward, who said this entire thing had been blown completely out of proportion. He said his client was accused of spitting at this agent's shoe. Maybe it might have all been unintentional. Cut to last night, the state's attorney's office abruptly announced that She, Eileen O'Neill Burke, had personally reviewed the case, and they would be dropping the charges.
Oh, okay. Well, there you have it.
That's that on that.
Case closed.
Well, and it's interesting, too. I mean, we've seen there are still pending charges, you know, from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office against, you know, folks who are out protesting Broadview. And there have been a lot of questions raised about, like, why are they still potentially, you know, facing a court date?
Interesting.
And I wonder whether this is, you know, signals some sort of a shift or if this is kind of a one-off.
Let's shift to a tragedy here in our city. Last month's fatal shooting of Loyola student Sheridan Gorman back on March 19th, it put Chicago back at the center of America's fight over immigration. And, of course, a senseless loss of life there in that case. The alleged suspect is a Venezuelan immigrant without legal status. And President Trump called the victim's family this week. Do we know what he said to them, Sophie?
As far as I know, we don't know exactly what was said yet. We know that this family is very connected to members of Trump's inner circle through their hometown of it's Yorktown Heights, New York. There was a massive vigil last weekend there where her family spoke about, you know, their desire to seek justice. They've been very outspoken throughout on this entire case.
Yeah, they're criticizing Mayor Johnson, Governor Pritzker. They don't like their remarks since their daughter's death. And they say they don't want her name to be used in political arguments.
Right, yes. The family was extremely critical of comments made last week by the mayor, by the governor. We're very, you know, complimentary of the Chicago Police Department in the same statement, but took a lot of issue with those political statements. And like you said, they don't want their daughter being used in these sort of political conversations, but we've seen that's already happening on both sides of the aisle here. I mean, the Trump administration is tweeting almost daily about Sheridan at this point. And Jose Medina, the 25-year-old Venezuelan native, is already facing criminal charges for murder here in Cook County. But we saw yesterday he is now also facing federal gun charges because federal prosecutors said they don't want to take any chances on him ever getting out.
Brandon, Gorman's killing, it's become this political lightning rod, yes, and it's got, you know, what sticks out to me is these conservative commentators using this as a moment to come back and criticize Chicago and Illinois' sanctuary policies.
Yeah, and not just conservative commentators. I mean, even Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza made waves when she tweeted out almost immediately, send him to El Salvador, which parrots a lot of that kind of right-wing rhetoric you see, kind of surprising for a Democrat, you would think, in the state of Illinois. It just, you see this immigration conversation get so muddied so often. Obviously, there's a lot of emotion that's there. And the sad part is oftentimes hardworking immigrants who contribute to this country every day get scapegoated in the conversation and become victims to all the different rhetoric that's going around. It's tough to see. But at the end of the day, you'd hope that we get back to a point where people can kind of be a little more cooler, let less emotion go out there before they respond and put out tweets and statements. But of course, leadership starts at the top.
Yeah.
And it's coming from the top down.
All right. So we're continuing to see a lot of upheaval among the mayor's top staff and among leadership in sister agencies. Nick, I want to start with the Chicago Housing Authority, or CHA.
Right.
What should we know?
Take it away, Nick. About 2 weeks ago, we got a somewhat of a surprise announcement that the CHA, after a year and a half without a permanent leader, had the board had opted for Keith Pettigrew, who had been previously reported as a finalist for CHA CEO. He is currently leading public housing in D.C. They said they had voted to offer him the job. He'd accepted. And Mayor Brandon Johnson was not happy about that. He, of course, had been hoping for now former Alderman Walter Burnett to take over. There had been all sorts of conflict of interest issues. There was a, you know, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development review because Burnett and his wife are landlords, and they have properties where folks who use housing vouchers, you know, live. So that was, you know, potentially a conflict of interest that was under review that really muddied the waters. CHA board decided to move ahead, kind of bucking the mayor on this.
Yeah. So, I mean, the point is here that the mayor historically has chosen the leader of this of this agency, but with the board essentially just kind of being a rubber stamp.
And this is going to test the law here, because right. Mayor Brandon Johnson now has moved to remove the chair of the CHA board, which he does have the authority to do. He can't remove him from the Board of Commissioners, but the mayor does appoint the chairman of the CHA board. But with that removal, Mayor Johnson is saying this CEO contract is invalid, and for a number of reasons, one of which is he's saying they violated the Open Meetings Act, and a lot of this is going to hinge, I think, on three little words, which is general subject matter. Mm. A public body has to put out an agenda, 48 hours in advance of a meeting, and they have to say the general subject matter of each topic they're going to discuss. Right. CHA agenda for that meeting was pretty vague. It was, about basically personnel matters. It didn't say anything specifically about a chief executive officer, anything like that. So I think that's sort of the crux of the mayor's argument here is that they said they were going to go into closed session to discuss personnel. They were going to vote on it, but they didn't say what it was.
Before we move to another departure, I want to get your opinion on this, Brandon, because Matthew Brewer didn't take this quietly. He said the mayor has, quote, put politics and cronies over the best interests of our CHA residents. What do you think about the head of the CHA talking about the mayor that way?
It's not normal. I can't think of a time I've seen a statement that sharp against the mayor. Usually these agencies kind of work in collaboration, right? It's a fascinating debate because Brewer is making the argument that, Johnson has the authority under the Illinois Housing Authorities Act to appoint me, kind of a created position because of this interim thing going on, but that the board has the discretion when it comes to getting an actual head of the CHA and not the mayor himself. Which kind of, as you mentioned, we have a history of it's usually a rubber stamp, but the law is the law here. Is the mayor here arguing he did not know this was going to happen? This is also coming at a time, we're going to talk about these other ones. Who's running these agencies?
Yeah. Well, let's get into the next one. I got to talk about this. This one surprised me. The city's first chief homelessness officer, Cindy Soto.
Yeah.
She's out.
Yep.
What happened?
Well, this was a grant-funded position. So, all the reporting around this and all the announcements at the time were that this was never intended necessarily to be a permanent position. It's something they would have had to make room in the municipal budget for. But originally, there was a group of funders.
I didn't catch that at the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't know. That must have passed me by. I thought she was here to stay.
And I don't know that was necessarily a big part of the announcement.
It was never publicized. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is it me? Did I not read the fine print?
You're not the only one.
It's not just you, Sasha.
Okay.
No, and I think that there was a group of funders came together to make this position a reality. But from the reporting, originally this was supposed to be a 3-year position. Soto now leaving at the 2-year mark. Now, in her statement with her departure, very gracious, very celebratory of the work that they'd been able to do. So if there is bad blood here, we haven't seen any indication of that yet. But she was really out front with the mayor on a lot of these issues, with this sort of housing first approach that the Johnson administration has prioritized when it comes to addressing homelessness. Obviously, the proliferation of tent encampments, in parkland and other public property that we've seen as homelessness has continued to be such a huge issue.
There's a housing crisis in the city,
absolutely,
Nick, and a statewide and nationwide crisis,
absolutely,
as well. So, is the impact of a loss like this to Chicagoans?
It's a huge loss because, a lot of the issue in addressing homelessness, you hear this from advocates over and over, I've done reporting on this over the years, is that it's all these disparate systems that aren't talking to each other. There's, there's housing, there's mental health, there's physical health, there's all sorts, there's, do you have the documents you need? Do you have the transportation you need? So it's a lot of different, agencies, departments, public, private, nonprofit, that don't necessarily all talk to one another. And I think the idea behind this was to have someone truly coordinating the policy at a high level. Now, Soto, part of her mandate was to come up with this big sort of 5-year plan for how we tackle these things.
Right.
That's expected to be out early next week.
She's dropping that soon.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, the idea perhaps is that we have that roadmap and that can sort of serve as, okay, here's what everybody is supposed to do. But, often
I feel like someone should still be here to implement it.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't just drop a report and be like, bye.
See ya.
And to your point, Sasha, there was a great report from Chicago Coalition and Homelessness. They estimate that homelessness has increased in the city in Cook County by 18% over the last year. Meanwhile, we just talked about CHA, the lack of affordable housing in the city. Both of these things.
20-year wait list or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Both of these things correlate. And it's kind of pressing that now the two kind of heads of the snake here that should be able to handle that It's not handled.
They're gone. And Sophie, wasn't it just 2 weeks ago that Garion Gatewood, who's the deputy mayor for community safety, was fired? Could his departure have a significant impact on safety in Chicago as we get towards, you know, this right. warmer weather? We know what happens when it gets warmer.
I mean, feels like just yesterday. But yeah, Gatewood was abruptly brought into an office with Johnson's chief of staff and one of his top aides and told they were moving in another direction is what they said to him. We've heard rumors circulate about, you know, allegations of a toxic workplace. Gatewood's deputy was also let go, is now coming out to say that the Johnson administration actually has an anti-police bias that's contributing to all this. Bigger picture, larger concern is what does this mean for the warmer summer months?
Right.
People are raising a lot of concerns. I mean, just the week before Gatewood was let go, Johnson sent out a press release applauding the initiative that Gatewood had led last summer, saying it contributed to record low homicide numbers.
Ah, boy. The timing of that.
Not great.
You also have the CTA doesn't have a leader right now. Even.
More than a year.
Oh, geez, did I forget one? Yeah.
Yeah.
So many. County residents might have wished it was an April Fool's trick, but unfortunately, it wasn't. I'm talking about the first installment of property taxes that were due on April 1st. Nick, a new report from the Cook County Treasurer had some details on just how much those taxes have risen in recent years. What can you share?
It's been pretty significant. They did an analysis of 30 years of data, 1995 to 2004. They found that property taxes increased at double the rate of inflation. So over the course of that 30 years, inflation was 90%. Property taxes went up 180%.
Wow.
Also outpaced wage growth, which was just 160%. So it really hits a lot of Cook County homeowners where it hurts. And they said there's a lot of factors that go into this. TIF districts, everybody's favorite topic. Those have proliferated. They rose about 1,000% over that 30-year period. And, you know, Pappas is calling for changes in state law. Now, there is a law on the books in Illinois that is supposed to cap property tax increases at either the rate of inflation or 5%, whichever is lower. But there's all sorts of loopholes. If voters approve property tax increases by referenda or, home rule districts like, for example, Chicago, they have a lot more leeway here. So she wants to see big changes to the system.
Yeah, let's hear from her. Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas was on WBEZ's Say More this week. I want to play a little bit of why she says property taxes are going up.
Spending is out of control. It's not just Springfield coming in and saying, hey, let's get rid of these loopholes. At some point, all 2,200 governments have to say, the citizens, the 80% of the people who don't bother to show up to vote, have to stand up and quit complaining and say, hey, I need some accountability here. We got to quit spending as much as we're spending.
Is that the solution, Brandon? Cut back on government services and spending?
I think that could be a solution. I think ultimately, too, we're in the midst of an affordability crisis. Many have talked about it. And so I think at the end of the day, when you want to talk about home ownership, that reality is shrinking for millennials, for everybody.
If I read another article about, the 40 plus, able to own homes anymore.
There was an outstanding article in the Huffington Post that came out this week about how more people are moving to the Midwest because they find it cheaper. Mm-hmm. But what it specified was that when it comes to Illinois, people are not going to Chicago. Mm-hmm. They're going to Rockford.
Which is a lovely town.
Lovely town.
Shout out to everybody from Rockford.
But it
Cheap
goes
trick.
Against conventional wisdom. But that's because the affordability issue. So does spending help bring that down? In theory, yes.
Yeah.
But,
Well, and I think it's worth mentioning, too, Pappas is up for re-election as treasurer
Absolutely.
In the fall. She has also said she is running for mayor next year. Now, and I will say—
While also saying she's not making making it, it's not an official announcement.
Right, it's an official, unofficial announcement. And credit where credit's due. Her office has done a bunch of these kinds of reports over the last several years, you know, trying to get into really the nitty-gritty of why the property tax system is the way that it is.
And Nick, Illinois has a state law that says taxes should not rise faster than inflation.
Yes, but it is rife
with
loopholes. Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of exceptions, as there are in many laws on the books here.
Let's pivot now and talk about last Saturday's No Kings demonstrations. I know our world is moving so quickly, folks. It seems like that was forever ago, but it was this week. Yeah. There were thousands of protests across the country. Local organizers estimate more than 200,000 people came to the Grant Park rally, and that included Mayor Brandon Johnson.
We're going to end this assault against working people. We're going to end these assaults against immigrants. And we're going to end these endless wars and stand up for our democracy. Are you with me, Chicago?
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who's now the Democratic candidate for Dick Durbin's U.S. Senate seat, also spoke to the Grant Park crowd.
He's dragged us into another war. Did any of us ask for that?
No!
No!
Brandon, besides the massive event in Grant Park, rallies were held in many suburbs, including ones that lean left, like Evanston and Highland Park. But there were rallies in areas that traditionally vote Republican. I'm talking about Orland Park, Barrington, Wheaton, just to name a few. So what do you think? Is this a sign of a growing frustration with the Trump administration that even more conservative communities are speaking out?
Well, it's a mix of two things. I've been looking at this for a while. Illinois suburbs, especially Chicago suburbs, have been shifting, especially the Republican strongholds, from red to blue for quite some time since Barack Obama came into office. But what you're seeing now, too, even Trump's most ardent base, especially independents who tend to be more in those Republican strongholds, latest polling shows nationally and locally that they are souring on him. They're not happy with some of the actions, especially with the war in Iran. They're not happy with gas prices right now, which have continued to rise. And so people are kind of not getting what they were. They don't feel like they're getting what they were sold when they took that vote. And so they're taking action.
Democratic Senate candidate Juliana Stratton, I mean, she thinks voters do not want any more compromises with the White House. She wants to see Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer replaced. You talked, Nick, with the Republican candidate for Senate, Don Tracy.
Not quite.
You talked with him this week. What does he think voters want?
Well, he, you know, a lot of his issues are affordability. You know, he lays a lot of the blame still on the Biden administration. Also, a lot of questions around immigration. You know, he again thinks that, you know, the 4 years previous to President Trump retaking office were essentially open borders. He, you know, really went after Mayor Brandon Johnson, Governor J.B. Pritzker for the sort of sanctuary welcoming policies here. He, you know, really argued that having immigrant populations here is a huge driver of costs for, you know, Illinoisans and, you know, all sorts of, you know, issues around, you know, healthcare costs as well. Although, of course, you know, he and many of his Republican colleagues would like to see the Affordable Care Act replaced, you know, did not want to, you know, support continued subsidies that lapsed at the beginning of this year. So, you know, a lot of folks are sort of singing out of, maybe not singing out of the same hymnal, they're talking about the same issues. You know, they're talking about affordability because, you know, even the you know, the folks that support, you know, perhaps in the past supported President Trump and largely economic issues, you know, maybe in wealthier suburbs, places like, you know, Barrington that you mentioned, you know, high cost of groceries and $5 or $6 a gas of gallon, that affects wealthier people too. So I think Tracy is very aware of the fact that affordability is a huge issue here. The things that he sees as driving up the costs and the ways that he wants to bring those costs down differ pretty wildly from what Stratton has to say.
And when it comes to the midterms coming up soon, I mean, you're going to have to pay the piper at some point. You know, Republicans are in a tough position here, wanting to support the administration and their agenda, also trying to sell that agenda to folks at home when the administration can't sell the agenda itself, it seems like. So people are confused across the board, whether you're left or right, on what's going on and why these prices are rising.
Yeah. In other news, Sophie, let's talk about Superintendent Snelling again, because he's calling for hundreds of officers to be moved onto the streets from other jobs.
Yes, that is right. That's the recommendation of this long-awaited study on staffing within the Chicago Police Department. City Council commissioned this over 2 years ago now. It finally came out this week. And that is one of the top findings there, is that the Chicago Police Department needs more officers in the streets. Mm-hmm. They need more sergeants supervising these officers. And it also recommends, as you mentioned, shifting hundreds of sworn officers out of desk jobs that they think could be done by civilians. Mm-hmm. Now, this could potentially help offset that gap in what they see in officers on the streets, but otherwise there's hirings to be made during this difficult time.
And they're debating this while folks are talking about tightening the curfew because, of course, we had crowds on the streets for a different reason than the No Kings protest that we just talked about moments ago. Spring break was wrapping up for CPS students and teen gatherings in the Loop erupted into violence. Remind us what happened, Brandon.
Yeah, you've seen what you know, many of the news media call teen takeovers, what the kids call teen trends. You had four arrested for battery in Naperville with over 300 showing up for a teen trend. And in Hyde Park just this week, you saw more than a dozen cars vandalized. A 16-year-old was arrested for disorderly conduct and possession of a gun. Fortunately, no one injured there. Eight arrested last week from the downtown teen trend. I've done a lot of talking with the youth who are involved in these teen trends. Just last week, I spoke to a guy who wishes to remain anonymous, but he claims he is one of the organizers of these teen trends.
Oh, really?
And I asked him straight up, he's a young kid, why? What are we doing? And he said, look, the end of the day, and we've heard this before, we just don't have a lot of stuff we can do.
Yeah.
And so we are just trying to have a good time. We're trying to escape the trauma in our lives, and we just need an open space to do it. He says he doesn't want people to get hurt. Mm-hmm. That's not the intention, but that's just what ends up happening. I asked him, hey, what do you think about the mayor's initiatives, like the basketball nights in neighborhoods, the video game nights, things like that? And he gave me the snooze sound and said, yeah, that's all boring. We ain't showing up to that. So the challenge here that the city is facing is, like, how do you create these alternatives for these kids that are also attractive for them to attend?
Are they talking to young people before they plan these young people gatherings?
And that's the other issue right now. It seems more reactive than proactive. I can confirm there are discussions happening currently with different organizations and stakeholders with the mayor's office about trying to figure out what some additional programming could look like.
Right.
But you would think we knew spring break was coming.
Right.
And if we can plan for this.
We can make all sorts of plans.
Same time every year.
Yeah. Right?
And Nick, as the temperatures slowly get warmer, Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins, he's got another proposal related to this, right? He's been trying to prevent these so-called teen takeovers, teen trends, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, I mean, Hopkins has been pushing, you know, to give the Chicago police the ability to institute this sort of snap curfew, you know, with very little notice. And, you know, it's I don't know that the votes in city council have significantly changed on this. There were all sorts of questions about, you know, are we going to be, A, is this constitutional? Is this, you know, going to follow the law? Are we going to be criminalizing a lot of young people? And, you know, a lot of young people who the vast majority of them are, you know, maybe they're congregating in the street, they're violating some misdemeanor ordinances or whatever, but, you know, they're not violent, they're not doing anything, you know, to Brandon's point, you know, there aren't necessarily these sort of third spaces where people can go. They don't want to go to something that's organized by boring grownups and having been a teenager mood.
Yes.
Like, I get it. And, you know, they don't necessarily feel, you know, is there an open shopping mall they can go to? Is there a basketball court where they feel safe playing, you know, a game organized on their own? Are there places where they can gather? And, you know, you hear from a lot of critics saying, well, the parents need to step up. And obviously, sure, parents have a role in teenagers' lives. But, I mean, are a bunch of 16-year-olds supposed to sit in their parents' house all day and never see their friends and never go do stuff?
As a parent of a 17-year-old, I mean, I want her to go do things. I mean, she has a job, so she goes out and she, you know, has her part-time job. And she has a little bit of a social life wherever it warrants. And I like that for her.
Right.
Like that for her. And she's doing things that are productive and, you know, keeping herself out of trouble. But anyone, I mean, you've all sort of touched this topic in your reporting in some way, shape, or form. Looking at you, too, covering public safety, Sophie. Yeah. I mean, anything else you're hearing from the teens themselves or the parents or just community organizers?
I mean, no, it seems like we've written this story every
every
few weeks.
Got it on autopilot.
Yes. Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, it's so difficult. These are like the beaches and Millennium Park, and these spaces are for everyone to enjoy. I mean, I don't think I'm alone here, but like being a teen in the city myself years ago, that is what you did. You'd gathered, and you know, it would. Same things were happening back then, maybe by a different title. I think they used to call it like flat, not to be confused with the flash mob dance things, but I think that was like the media term of the time. Yeah. Flash mob.
Flash mob.
Flash mobs at Water Tower Place.
Oh.
And like we said, that's the mall. That's where teens, you know, in any other circumstances are encouraged to hang out.
Well, right. If Hopkins has anything to say about it, we're not going to be done talking about this anytime soon. Brandon, I think I know what you're going to be doing tomorrow night. The Fighting Illini, they're in the Final Four, the first time since 2005.
Mm-hmm.
How's it looking for them?
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a matchup. These are two great Final Four matchups. This could be a national championship in itself. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, it's not. UConn, this is a powerhouse program that is seeking to gain, their third national title in 4 years.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty impressive. Illinois seeking their first since 2005. This is Brad Underwood, the coach's first Final Four appearance. This would be, if Illinois can go all the way, the Big Ten Conference's first ever championship since the year 2000 with Mateen Cleaves and Michigan State back in the day. It's an impressive thing. When you look at what the Illinois story is, there's been a lot of talk about the Balkan Five, the fact that they've been embracing international recruiting, European players, Peja Stojakovic's kid, kind of mirroring what the NBA is going through on the college side. NIL, you can now pay players. The impact of that, you create a really dominant Illinois team in that to revive a program that really has been sputtering after Bruce Weber's tenure. So it's going to be an exciting time for Illinois fans.
And Sophie, judging by the hat that you're wearing in studio right now, something tells me you are a Michigan graduate.
The leaders and best.
Ooh. Are you going to be watching the Wolverines take on Arizona tomorrow?
I will be there on the ground.
Really?
Indianapolis.
Yep.
You're doing the drive.
Doing the drive. I'll be in the finest nosebleeds money can buy. I think it's played in a football stadium. I'll probably bring binoculars as well, but very excited for our Wolverines. Going to be a crazy game. I love the Illini team as well. They're a fun watch, and go Big Ten, but
yeah,
I think it's the time for curtains for them.
But. Yeah, so it's a weekend in Indianapolis for you.
In Indianapolis. I've had the privilege of being there a few times for other various Michigan championship games.
Yeah.
All right.
As the son of a Michigan State graduate and an Arizona State graduate myself, Michigan-Arizona is my nightmare matchup, so and I'm all in for the Illini.
Oh, jeez.
And as an Ohio State fan, I'm just a hater. Just a hater.
I want to pivot now to, we got some drama involving the Chicago Bulls, Brandon. They've dismissed guard Jaden Ivey for, quote, conduct detrimental to the team. Fill us in on his, you made some comments about Pride Month.
Yeah, a stunning fall from grace from a guy that's a top five NBA draft pick coming out of Purdue. Great kid, great family. His mother, Niel Ivey, is the head coach of Notre Dame women's basketball. On Monday, he blasted the NBA for having Pride Nights. He called them unrighteous. He criticized Catholicism, which is awkward because his mom coaches at a Catholic school. And so, yeah, he was waived for conduct detrimental to the team. But this has been building for a while. There were press conferences where Ivy was even, like, pressing reporters, asking them, are you saved? Have you fornicated? And things like that.
Oh, really?
Very, very jaw-dropping things. And so this was kind of building for a while. But also there's been a lot of talk. He was very open on some podcasts about him having depression and his battles with that. Many folks kind of concerned about what's going on with that. Meanwhile, his wife has come out publicly for the first time. He's said on his Instagram Lives that she has ceased contact with him. That is not true. There's a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
On the Bulls side of things, the Bulls taking action had to be done. But many are saying, hey, the Bulls didn't do their due diligence in the first place because the Pistons were the team that he was traded from, the Detroit Pistons. They had these issues as well with him. And it was pretty well known around league circles.
Okay, so
this
it
seemed like they took kind of a risk.
Pretty well documented behavior.
Absolutely.
And so it was only a matter of time, I think, before something went, I guess, you know, in the eyes of the NBA, too far and would catch up.
Way too far.
Let's pivot to the conversation about the closing of West Suburban Hospital. What's happening, Nick?
That's right. This is a safety net hospital. For the last 4 years, it's been owned by Manoj Prasad, who also took over ownership of Weiss Memorial Hospital in Uptown. Both of these are safety net institutions. You know, Weiss, of course, was forced to close after it lost access to Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, which was the vast, vast majority of its revenue. Also issues, you know, around, you know, making sure the HVAC was working, making sure they had appropriate staffing and equipment. And unfortunately, we saw a lot of these same issues. Federal regulators cited West Suburban for this as well. You know, there was an issue where they didn't have adequate X-ray machines, where there was questions about, you know, whether there was an ICU doctor available for patients in critical need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so basically they said they, you know, he says he's committed to making sure these institutions stay open,
right,
to making sure that they serve this need. We saw a state representative, LaShawn Ford, who represents that area, appeared at a press conference with Prasad, but they didn't necessarily seem to be on the same page. Ford said that's awkward. Yeah, just a little bit. There's some great photojournalism that I recommend everybody look up to kind of get an idea of the tenor of the conversation.
Okay.
But, you know, basically Ford's saying he's there as the advocate for the community. He wants to see this happen. Maybe there needs to be some state funding to come in to help right the ship. But there are still a lot of questions about the quality of the management there. We also heard from one of the head of the medical staff there who, you know, also she raised a lot of issues with the leadership at West Suburban. But, you know, ultimately at this is a really, really critical institution for a lot of folks, you know, a lot of low income, Black and Latino patients, a lot of people who maybe don't have transportation to get to another facility.
Right.
Or if there is some, you know, immediate emergency, that's the closest, you know, emergency department for a lot of people. So a lot of folks really eager to see this institution reopen, but a lot of unanswered questions about whether they have the money and whether they have the appropriate management in place.
In other news, finalists for the James Beard Award, which is considered the sort of Oscars of the food world, they were announced this week. And so congrats are in order to three Chicagoans, Bailey Sullivan of West Loop's Monteverde and Pastificio, who's a finalist in the Emerging Chef category. And we have Norman Fenton of Carino in Uptown and Jacob Potashnik of Feld in Ukrainian Village. They are both finalists in the Best Chef Great Lakes category. So round of applause for them.
Yeah.
Have any of you eaten at those restaurants?
No, I'd like to.
Yeah. I snagged a Monteverde reservation, I think, many years ago. Oh. It was at 5 o'clock, I want to say. And it was, it's everything they say and more. I would love to get back
sometime. Is the pasta as good as they say?
It is as good as they say.
Yeah.
We have such a wealth of culinary talent here.
I was just going to say, Brandon, you, in you know, conversations I've had with you outside of work, just in our social circles, you are constantly bragging about this city.
Oh, yeah.
And just all of our Michelin stars.
Top tier.
Yeah. How big of a deal do you think this is for Chicago, because I'm looking at the fact that the James Beard Awards, it moved here back in, 2015 from New York. Mm-hmm. It sounds like we have at least two more years of it being here. Like that's
They extended.
And it comes at a time where there's been some dramatic conversation about is Chicago losing some of its culinary status. We saw what happened with Alinea losing a Michelin star, that was very controversial.
Yeah.
This kind of reaffirms, hey, Chicago's still got a place here. There's a wealth of talent here. And guess what? When they have the awards here, I will be eating. It's my favorite weekend in the city.
And I got to say, Jacob Potashnik, what a classic Chicago name. You got to give it to him for that.
I was making sure I didn't mess that one up. Well, tell me, what stories are on your radar for next week? This was a jam-packed recap this week. What are you looking at when you look ahead, Sophie?
Oh, gosh.
When you get back from Indianapolis.
Well, hopefully I'll be out of office until Tuesday morning, if all things go well. But yeah, following up
Sophie's
on
Sophie's out of office reply is like already created.
Probably shouldn't have said that on there. We'll get that okay for someone later.
Out of office just
later.
Says go blue.
Pending approval. a lot of the same stories we're following up on. I mean, a lot of these major cases, including Sheridan Gorman, are going to be due back up in court next week and the week following. Also continuing to follow this demand for action from the state's attorney, Eileen O'Neill Burke's office.
Yeah.
The case for a special prosecutor is due back up. We're going to hear arguments for the side that's pushing for that. Yeah, lots to follow there.
Lots on your beat, Nick.
Well, speaking of sister agencies, the Chicago Transit Authority Board meets bright and early on Wednesday morning. Mm-hmm. I will be there, and I will be very interested because this is the first meeting they've had since the CTA successfully sued to unfreeze funding for the Red Line extension last month. So I anticipate there will be quite a bit of conversation about
that. I hope you'll have
that.
A cup of coffee.
I certainly will.
And Brandon?
Well, you know, NFL league meetings are wrapping up, and Kevin Warren, the Bears team CEO, has set a late spring, early summer deadline. And a pressure is being applied to him by the NFL commissioner to make a decision on what he wants to do about this stadium. He's already said it's not going to be in the city of Chicago. So it's Arlington Heights or is Indiana. I think that decision could come next week, but I'm going to be tracking to see what happens with that.
That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to freelance journalist Brandon Pope, WTTW's Nick Blumberg, and Sophie Sherry of the Sun-Times. Have a good weekend, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.